Welcome to The Rest is History, and to this, the return of the king of our Olympic podcast trilogy. So Tolkien originally began The Lord of the Rings thinking it would be one short book, and it turned into three monsters. We decided to do a podcast on the ancient Olympics, and then we decided to do the modern Olympics, and that's turned into two podcasts just on the modern Olympics. It definitely won't be three, because I don't think we have enough material. But we have tons of good stuff, don't we, Tom? The modern Olympics. What a weird...
Well, I'm hoping that you do. I'm less knowledable about this.
That's all right.
This is very much your patch.
I can talk about Daley Thompson for hours.
Yeah, Daley Thompson, but also the Cold War, I guess.
Which is
the great backdrop to this.
It is, absolutely.
So, in the previous one, we got to the Second World War.
Yeah.
And London was due to host the 1944 Games. Obvious reasons, couldn't, because London was busy with other things. But in the wake of that, London gets the Games in 1948.
Yeah.
And it's blitzed, it's bombed out, it's austerity games.
London is in a worse condition in 1948 than it probably would have been in 1944, because austerity is bitten so deep.
Kicked in, yeah. So we talked in the first part about the problems that people had with the swimming. People kind of contracting typhoid because it had been set in a lagoon or getting caught up on the currents of rivers. There is a swimming pool in the London Games, but it has a massive crack due to bomb damage. And so all the way through, they have to keep topping it up.
That's a good story. That basically conforms to... I mean, American athletes must have been utterly unsurprised by that. That must have absolutely conformed to their image of 1940s London as this sort of grey, shabby... decaying,
yes,
which it was
kind of 1948. I mean, 1984. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's the city of,
and the athletes stay in RAF camps, don't they? So it's so kind of in the shadow of the war. They even, because everybody's on rationing, they get given the special rations that are given to miners, to coal miners.
Yes.
So yeah,
but generally, also Dominic, they get given soap, but they're asked to bring their own towels.
Bring your own. That's great. That's like where, you know, people, when they go on holiday in Scandinavia, they often take their own sheets when they book these kind of cabins and chalets and stuff. There's this sort of spirit of, you know, you bring your own stuff and whatnot. Maybe the Olympics should be done on that principle. It would sort of remove some of the hubris.
Yes,
it would. Puncture some of the... The Olympic Village, you know, you should all be... bring your own towel.
So anyway, so that was the London Olympics.
And they've sort of lost touch at that point, haven't they? With the, I mean, for utterly understandable and indeed in perhaps admirable reasons, the London Olympics have broken with the 1936 pattern that we talked about in the last episode. So in the last episode, we talked about how two games, Los Angeles and Berlin, created the modern Olympics with the torch, with the relay, carrying the torch, with the podiums, with the playing of anthems, with the sort of fascistic iconography. But London in 1948 doesn't really seem to have that, does it? It's all a bit sort of shabby and a bit sort of...
But the shabbiness becomes the point, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is the point.
I mean, that's the whole point.
Even in baggy trousers and stuff.
I think the only infrastructure that is built is half a mile of pavement to get pedestrians from somewhere to somewhere else.
But I mean, for obvious
reasons,
that's
basically it.
They had a much more, arguably, a much healthier attitude towards Olympic infrastructure than we do now, because they had other things to spend money on. And but also because there's a revulsion from the excesses of 36, because I think even at that point, the Berlin Games are beginning to assume this sort of incredibly diabolical role in the story of Hitler and his rise to power and appeasement and the world sort of blinding themselves to the realities of his regime.
The story from 1948 onwards, though, is increasingly extravagant infrastructure, TV, and Cold War rivalry. So the Soviet Union, victor in the war, great power, does not come to London. Ideologically, supposedly, it disapproves of this, you know, the Corinthian spirit. I mean, unsurprisingly. But 1952... at Helsinki, and Finland, of course, is in a shadowy way, kind of vaguely under the Soviet aegis.
What's fascinating kind of about it.
It's the Venn diagram. It's the centre of the Venn diagram between the West and the Soviet bloc. There, the Soviets do compete, and there's a kind of wonderful contrast between the first female gold medal winner that America has, who's Margaret Abbott, that we talked about in the previous one.
Yes, who wins by accident, basically.
Wins by accident, was studying art, and this kind of glorious photo of her competing. She's got long white skirts, she's got a hat, you know, kind of gloriously Edwardian look. The first woman to win a gold medal for the Soviet Union is Nina Ramashkova, who wins the women's discus. And she is an alumna of the physical training faculty of the Stavropol Pedagogical Institute. And she very, very much looks like it.
Okay.
You could not imagine her in a kind of hat, mentioned ivory hat, looking like Helena Bonham Carter.
She wouldn't go punting.
She would not go punting. She'd sink the punt, I think it's fair to say.
Right.
She's solid muscle.
Yeah.
And I guess that kind of establishes a template for the Soviet-American rivalry that will run right the way up till, I guess, you know, the boycotted Olympics of the 80s.
Yeah, that's right.
Moscow and LA.
And I think the Soviet Union already had, for a few years, it had a history of sport as propaganda, sport as a vehicle for proclaiming, the key thing is proclaiming the modernity of the Soviet system. So they'd sent, for example, football teams to tour England, and they had played, you know, what was perceived to be a more collective, more advanced, more progressive game. And I think this sort of, I mean, people talk about Homo Sovieticus, the sort of Soviet man. And the idea was that Soviet man, indeed Soviet woman, particularly Soviet woman as it became, were that they were almost kind of supermen and superwomen. That thanks to the appliance of Soviet science, they would outstrip all their Western competitors. And this became an obsession, as we know, for the sort of Soviet, and then of course the East German, Czechoslovakian, Hungarian, so on authorities.
So this is a problem for the Olympic Committee, isn't it? That basically that kind of Corinthian ideal doesn't play in a communist society. And the Soviets have absolutely no compunction about training people for 4 years,
yeah,
solely with the aim of getting them. I mean, ironically, they're kind of more like the very aristocratic figures in the ancient Olympics.
They are, and they're technically amateurs, aren't they? I mean, they're always, these Eastern European and Russian competitors are technically amateurs. They might be in the army, or they might be, you know, the sort of commentators,
PE teachers,
are policemen or something like this. But of course, the reality is they're spending all their time training, and indeed being pumped with, as certainly by the 70s. Being pumped with chemicals to sort of bend the rules and give them the advantage.
So, how much is that being done?
Lots, yeah, lots.
That's a massive program.
It's East Germany is the most famous example. East Germany by the 70s and 80s, you know, I think they have this colossal state-sponsored doping program, and of course there are, you know, all these horror stories about particularly East German women. Who are basically forced,
kind of growing beards and things.
Yeah, who are forced to take all these treatments, whether they want to or not, really, if you want to succeed.
And for the East Germans, is that because they are competing as, you know, one half of what had been Germany? So they
absolutely
are targeting.
They have
and so
to
when,
be.
And so when the West Germans get the games at Munich, I guess that must kind of turbocharge it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think absolutely. And I think by the 80s, it had become almost a parody of itself. I mean, I can remember as a boy watching the East German athletes and the sort of world weariness in the BBC commentators' tones. When, you know,
another hammer is chucked 5 miles.
Yeah, exactly. By somebody who looks like, you know, the Incredible Hulk or something. I mean, it's easy to laugh about it, but there were real tragic stories kind of behind it. Because, of course, they didn't really have a choice. Because if you chose to opt out, if you were identified as talented and you chose to opt out of the system, the consequences for your family could be very grave. You know, you would miss out, you'd move down the housing list, miss out on lots of perks of various kinds, be identified as sort of skeptics or enemies of the state. So the pressure on these women in particular was absolutely intense. And that's not just in East Germany. I mean, you read the stories about people like Nadia Comăneci, for example, in Romania. I mean, Nadia Comăneci was put under immense pressure in the 70s and early 80s as a sort of, because she was the absolute symbol of Ceausescu's regime around the world. And so she had very, it was just kind of stifling.
But Ceausescu is, I mean, he's slightly kind of at a remove, isn't he? So the Americans boycott Moscow because the Soviets have just invaded Afghanistan. And then when the Soviets boycott Los Angeles, Ceausescu does go.
Well, because Romania remains in a slightly semi-detached... I mean, Romania is having its cake and eating it. Not as much as Yugoslavia, but Romania is having its cake and eating it. So it's trying to get currency from the West. It's sort of positioning itself. I mean, this is one of the reasons Ceausescu was decorated by the Queen. Remember, he comes to Buckingham Palace, I think, and is given some sort of order.
Yeah, he stays in the bedroom, doesn't he?
Because Romania is trying to position itself as the cuddly face of Eastern European communism, which obviously, ironically, it completely and utterly wasn't. So Ceausescu is exactly, he's trying to steer this.
And so do you have a sense of how important it was to both America and the Soviet Union?
Yes,
that they
massively
beat each
important.
Other in the medal tables.
It's absolutely massively important. So the Soviet Union is very successful in the 50s and 60s. There are confrontations starting right away. So the classic early confrontation is in Melbourne in 1956. So it's December 1956. It's after the Suez Crisis, but it's also crucially after the Red Army's repression in Hungary of the Hungarian uprising. And there's this landmark water polo match between Hungary and the USSR. So the Hungarians are very good at water polo. I mean, who would? I guess they've got their tradition of baths, haven't they, in Budapest? Maybe that explains
yes.
why they're so, why they're
throwing
so good at
soap
it.
At each other.
Yeah. So the Hungarians, I think, are the reigning champions, and they've been training for ages, and they have this match. It's sort of a quarter final or something. I can't remember exactly. So it's December 56. They have this match with the Russians. It's called the Blood in the Water match. That's how it's gone down, because at the there was so much fighting at the end. One of the Hungarians, a guy called Ervin Zador, is punched or elbowed. He takes his eye off his Russian opponent for a second to ask the referee something, and the next thing he knows, his nose has been broken and there's kind of blood pouring from his face. The crowd, which was mainly Hungarian, sort of Hungarian Australians, they start shouting, and a lot of them start spitting at the Soviet players. And it ends in this massive punch-up. The Hungarians win 4-0.
Hungarians win.
And they win the gold medal, I think. But a lot of their players defect, including the guy who was blooded, Ervin Zador. He ends up being a water polo coach in California, bizarrely.
Wow.
So right there you have the absolute... I mean, that's one story. Probably the other very famous...
The ice hockey. The famous ice hockey match.
The
right?
Miracle on Ice. Lake
Placid. When is that?
That's 1980, I think it is. So that's played...
Okay, so that's before the Americans have boycotted
is it before...
the Moscow Summer Games. So
yes, I think it's at the beginning of 1980, if I remember right, the Winter Olympics. I mean, if I'm wrong, listeners will correct me. And of course, it's amateur. So the people who are playing in the United States team are not professional ice hockey players. They're not the big stars from the NHL. The Soviets always win. And...
February 1980.
The producer was telling us February 1980. I feel very
Thank
proud
you,
of myself. and the Soviets, yeah, they always win, and this time they don't. And it's in front of this incredibly partisan American crowd, and these amateurs, I think they're basically college kids, they win. And it's this incredible shock. And actually, that moment is probably the moment where you see the... You know, you can trace the spirit of the LA Games 4 years later, that the turbocharged American patriotism from the Miracle on Ice in Lake Placid, because there you suddenly have... Because, of course, America doesn't get to play other countries. This is why one reason, I think, why the Olympics matter in America far more than they do in, let's say, Britain or European countries. Because Americans don't get to play other countries very often in international sport. Because, of course, their own sports, they're the only people that play them.
Dominic, you're not allowed to say that or you'll get in trouble.
Well, other people do play basketball, fine. We've got the basketballer Files who bombarded us with
yes.
demented tweets last time. But the American teams don't play international teams, do they? I mean, in
not
basketball
very often.
So that's why...
Well, they do occasionally play Iran at football.
They do. Yes,
throw
they do.
That one out.
Anyway, so this is all...
Yeah, no, I get that.
A bit of a sort of rambling... So then you've got Moscow 1980, and Moscow 1980 is where it becomes where the boycotts obviously start. And you know the weird thing about that, Tom, is this is Jimmy Carter's wheeze. You know, the Russians have invaded Afghanistan. But it was, I'm not saying this as a sort of, I'm not a sort of Cold War dove or anything. But it was a complete overreaction by Carter to boycott the Moscow Games, actually.
Was it for kind of to look strong?
I think a lot of it was to look strong. He was perceived as weak. The election was coming against Ronald Reagan, and Reagan was bound to. I mean, Afghanistan was already a Soviet client state. So the sort of rhetoric around the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was pretty inflated, actually. And
is that why, say, Britain went?
Well, Mrs. Thatcher put enormous pressure on the British athletes not to go. But politics doesn't get involved with sport. The British government couldn't legally prevent them from going. There was enormous furore in the newspapers. I mean, I've written about this in my most recent book in my series on Britain. And it's absolutely fascinating going through. But there was a real sense of debate, actually. So even in very sort of anti-communist newspapers, The Times, let's say, or The Daily Express, the letters pages, the editorial columns, they would often give views for and against, and people would be, the sports journalists in particular were adamant that it would be really unfair on the athletes not to go. And the athletes themselves generally wanted to go. I think Daley Thompson was asked about it, said he didn't give a damn about that. They were his words.
He was great.
He said, I don't give a damn about the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. I'm going to win gold. At one point, Douglas Hurd, who was Minister of State at the Foreign Office, he goes for a meeting with Peter Coe, Sebastian Coe's trainer, and tries to persuade him that Seb shouldn't go to Moscow. And Peter Coe's like, we're going. The people who don't go, amusingly and entertainingly, the people who don't go, who are precisely the people who you would assume would be the most right-wing because they have gone to private schools. So the equestrians don't go.
So no dressage.
There's no dressage, and the yachting fraternity refused to go to Moscow, but everybody else goes. And obviously, British fortunes, by the way, Britain had performed abysmally in the Olympics at the '70s, and we sort of clambered a little bit off the canvas
because that's the Steve Yvette and Sebastian Coe.
Exactly. They beat each other at each other's specialism.
Yeah.
Daley Thompson wins gold in the decathlon, and Alan Wells wins gold in the 100 metres. So for Britain, this is a great sort of hurrah, hurrah, because the West Germans aren't there, the Americans and the Canadians aren't there. Yeah. And the Japanese aren't there. And but when they all come home, they don't get decorated initially. Mrs. Thatcher does not recommend them. Four medals.
And Sebastian Coe ends up a Tory MP, right?
He does. And, he does.
William Hague's judo instructor.
When William Hague goes down the log flume wearing his baseball cap that says Hague on it, as aficionados of William Hague will know that this disastrous photo opportunity after he became Tory leader in the 1990s, he goes down the log flume. Sebastian Coe is just behind him. And the log flume. Really enjoyed.
It's never pointed out, is it?
Anyway,
but listen, we
people remember Sebastian Coe for all the wrong things. They remember him for the Olympic golds, but not for the log flume, and it's not right.
No. Okay, but just sticking to the Cold War rather than to the career of William Hague. They both are equally important.
Yeah.
The Soviets' response to the American
ridiculous. Boycott, they then boycott LA.
But their initial plan is to wipe the floor with the Americans. So they start pumping in more drugs, more training.
Yes, yeah.
That's their plan.
Tom's all over this, as you can tell.
I'm all over it. Well, this is your period. I don't know. I mean, if they're the Spartans, I'll be fine. But it's a late boycott.
Is it? I haven't followed the
anyway,
Soviet
listen,
boycott.
This is quality podcast.
So then the American. Well, what happens is Moscow is a terrible games. Moscow is very drab. The security is suffocating. A lot of the city has been evacuated, so basically children have been taken out of Moscow. The foreign press corps basically write home and say, this is awful. Because a lot of them, don't forget, there's a lot of people who, people don't go to Moscow by and large in the 1960s and 70s. So all these people who normally report on sport, so they spend their time at Crystal Palace watching kind of slightly obscure athletics events. They go to Moscow and they're writing copy that's appearing in Western newspapers saying, God, this place is awful. You know, it's this sort of this image that we have of the Third Rome, you know, the capital of this superpower. But so in the 70s, everybody thinks represents modernity.
So the idea that we have, you know, that I remember growing up with, that Moscow is kind of queues and shabbiness.
Yeah.
Does that come from
a lot of it? I think does come from 1980, because these are people who are, there'd always been a sense of sort of it being a forbidding sort of dark citadel. But the sort of sense of just how awful it is.
Yeah.
A lot of that, I think, does come from the 1980 game, certainly in the British papers. And the sense that it's, because so much in the 70s of the talk about the Cold War had been that the Russians were winning. Because, of course, America's been humiliated in Vietnam. They've been Watergate. The Russians are penetrating Africa and so on. And then people go to the Moscow Games and they're like, oh, God, this is actually terrible.
So that's interesting, because in which case, that's an example of totalitarian Olympics
gone wrong. Yeah, exactly right. I think that's exactly right. I don't think anyone comes home from Moscow and says, oh, the Soviets are just as powerful as I had imagined they were. I think they come home with completely the opposite expression. And that, of course, nicely tees up Los Angeles, which is just the ultimate expression of kind of Reagan Americanism.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So immense corporate, you know, that's
Stars and Stripes.
Corporate sponsorship turned up to 11. You know, it's happening in California and Sunshine. The American news media goes completely berserk and basically doesn't mention the fact that anybody else is participating in the games at all, which really shocks a lot of even sympathetic kind of British and German and so on observers, because they can't believe how ultra patriotic the Americans are about their 84 games. It's Carl Lewis's games. And it's also the games at which Daley Thompson, great hero of mine, perhaps slightly disgraces himself by baiting Carl Lewis about the possibility that Carl Lewis is gay. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do vaguely.
So he walks around with a t-shirt on saying, is the world's second best athlete gay? And yes, when people ask him about it at the press conference, he says, oh, in England, gay means happy.
Yeah, I do vaguely remember. But Carl Lewis, I mean, he was photographed wearing stilettos, wasn't he?
Was he?
Oh, I don't know.
Where did you hear that from? Daley Thompson?
Probably. I don't know. I think we should have a break here.
Okay.
I'm just going to check that to make sure that I haven't.
I think it'd be great if this podcast is to be cancelled. I think being cancelled because you've slandered Carl Lewis.
Well, it's not slander
about his shoe choices.
No, if he wants to wear stilettos, that's fine. But I just want to make sure that's right. So let's have a break. I will go and check that.
Daley Thompson of historical podcasting, Tom Holland.
And I think that when we come back, we should look at TV.
Well, we've got TV, but we've also got some very dark chapters we haven't talked about. Okay. Mexico and Munich in particular.
Okay, so let's look at that when we come back.
Okay,
all right.
Very good.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Tom Holland, I believe you have something you want to say to the lawyers.
I do. Okay. So, yes, that subliminal memory that was floating around in my mind of Carl Lewis in stilettos is right. So it's not a false memory. It was part of an advertising campaign by the Italian tire company Pirelli. And I'm reading this off the internet. It was taken by American celebrity photographer Annie Leibovitz. And it showed him wearing a pair of red stiletto heels.
Okay.
So I was right.
That's interesting.
And I guess he may be making play with the Dave
maybe.
Thompson.
No, I don't think Carl Lewis is that. I don't think he's.
Knowing?
I'm not sure he's that ironic.
Okay.
Do you remember the Ben Johnson Carl Lewis? That was titanic when I was at school. I mean, everybody.
So that was Soul, wasn't it?
That was Soul. Everybody had a preference, either Lewis or Johnson. I remember Johnson winning and being delighted because I wanted him to win. And then.
But.
And then, yeah, the. And that's probably, it's up there with
Marin. So we should say, for people who don't know, that, I mean, Ben Johnson was absolutely up to his eyeballs in
drugs. Yeah, which I think, frankly, I'm not defending Ben Johnson.
All of them.
But it was true pretty generally for a lot of athletes, not all of them maybe, but for a lot of athletes in the 70s and in the 80s, well, 90s, actually.
Is this legally...
Well, I said not all of them. So if you're listening to this and you're an Olympic athlete,
one,
I don't mean you.
In the 70s, 80s and 90s.
I definitely don't mean you.
Please don't sue us.
I mean the other competitors. I mean...
The ones who did.
Yeah. then. But obviously at that point, by the Ben Johnson scandal was the biggest scandal probably in, the biggest doping scandal in Olympic history, and, you know, well, has meant that ever
apart
since.
Apart from Thomas Hicks in the...
The strychnine.
Being given the strychnine and the egg whites and the brandy.
Yes, well, yeah, that's
and of course
at the time.
Asterix in the Olympic Games, taking
that's
the
at the time,
magic potion.
It? Yeah. But I mean, apart from, I mean, the Ben Johnson scandal is a sort of supposedly a dark chapter in the history of the Olympics. But I mean, it isn't really compared with some of the dark chapters.
Brilliant segue.
So yeah,
brilliantly done. That was superb.
I'm glad you like that.
That was like dressage.
Even as I was doing it. See, had I been
the judges would give you 10 points for that.
Had I been a competitor in 1980, I wouldn't have had the chance to do that in Moscow.
Yeah,
but I could have. You know,
that was magnificent. You've podiumed with that.
Yeah,
so,
thank you.
So, okay,
oh, shocking. So
the dark moments.
So I think there are three games in a row, pretty much that are bad. The least bad of them is the last one, which is Montreal, and that's bad just for ludicrous overspending. So in that one, Montreal in 76, Canadian listeners, I know we have some Canadian listeners, and they will definitely remember this. The cost overrun by 720%. Montreal went $1 billion into debt, and they didn't pay off the debt for the stadium until 2006. I mean, just mind-boggling.
And you know about the mayor, Jean Drapeau.
Yes, the mayor. So
who said, a city can no more lose money on the Olympics than a man can have a baby.
Right, well,
and
couldn't say that now.
He also, he basically compared the Olympic Stadium in Montreal to the Acropolis.
But it still doesn't work. The Olympic Stadium in Montreal has never worked. It has this fancy retracting roof that they've had to repair.
Well, so I put this out on, I put this out on Twitter, and Canadian journalist James Menny replied, if memory serves, the roof of the Acropolis was blown to bits after the Ottomans used it as an ammunition dump. I think it was actually the Venetians, wasn't it? But anyway, the point is accurate. Our roof fell in because of snow.
Yeah. So well, it was incredibly crooked. The main construction union had links to organised crime. And basically, it's effectively bankrupted Montreal. And the city took decades and decades to recover.
So that's bad.
So that's bad, but not as bad as obviously the two previous games. So Mexico 1968. Mexico is a troubled country in the late 60s, huge student protests, a lot of police repression. And just before the games start, the Mexican government basically shoots and kills between 300 and 400 student protesters in the center of Mexico City. And the people who are most responsible for doing this are a special battalion called the Olympia Battalion of the Mexican security forces, who wear special, they're in plain clothes, they wear white gloves so that the other police won't fire on them, and they set up machine guns and basically machine gun the crowds.
That's not good preparation.
And there's a lot of talk about, you know, can the games go ahead under these circumstances? And the IOC president, who's an American, called Avery Brundage. Brundage was a terrible man. He was the man who had insisted that the Americans not boycott the Berlin Games in 1936. He had a history of anti-Semitism and sort of racist remarks and stuff. Brundage is asked, did you see this? And he says, no, I was at the ballet. So the Mexican Games go ahead. And then, of course, the Mexican Games...
So this guy Brundage, that's the context for the really famous image from the Mexican Games.
The Black Power Salute.
The Black Power Salute on the podium.
Yeah, Tommy Smith and John Carlos. So that, again, is a terrible story. So they do the Black Power Salute on the... And, of course, they do it in the context. Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were assassinated in 1968 in America. America's in the Vietnam War. It is racked by protests. The civil, you know, rights movement, the optimism is beginning to leak away. There have been race riots. It's all very troubled. And actually, against that background, merely doing a salute and a glove during the playing of your anthem doesn't really seem like such an incendiary.
So Tommy Smith wins. It's 200 metres, right?
I think it's 200 metres. There are three of them on
John
the
John Carlos comes third, and there's an Australian who comes second, he joins in.
He wears a badge. Peter Norman. It's actually a nice story. He is the one who suggests to them about the glove, that they have wear a glove each, because they tell him they want to do this. It's actually a story that reflects really well on all three of them. They say to him, we feel really strongly about this. We want to do this protest. And they say to him, do you believe in God? And he says, yes, because he's a member of the Salvation Army. Salvation Army background, and they say, well, that's why we want to do it. And he says, oh, I'll support you, you know. And they are basically banned from the Olympics forever by Avery Brundage, American, head of the IOC. And Peter Norman, there's a lot of controversy about this in Australia, whether it's for sporting reasons or for other reasons, but he's not, he doesn't get into the Australian team for the next Olympics. A lot of people have always thought that was because he was basically blacklisted because he had shown support for these two guys. So that's a very, I mean, that is the most famous image by far, one of the most famous images in Olympic history, but it's one from which the Olympic movement emerges with no credit whatsoever, I would say.
Yeah, there's a kind of sense of considerable sense of moral bankruptcy hanging over the Olympics throughout the 70s and 80s.
Well, Munich is a shocking...
And this is the worst,
It's a terrible story, really. So for listeners, most listeners will know this story, but for those who don't, September the 5th in Munich in West Germany, it's Germany's first chance to host the Olympics after 1936, so it matters enormously to the Germans that they present this sort of new face of Germany to the world. And eight members of the Palestinian Black September organization, they invade the Olympic Village. They take 11 Israeli athletes and officials hostage. Right at the beginning, they kill two of them, a wrestling coach and a wrestler. They kill and torture them really horribly. I mean, it's a terrible story.
And so this is in the context of the anti-Semitism that had stained the 36 Games.
Yeah.
As well.
So from the perspective of the Olympics, it could not be a worse story, right? I mean, because it's a reminder. You can't help think back to 1936.
Yeah.
But you know, the sort of adage about politics and sport don't mix is comprehensively demolished by this this incident. The terrorists then go with the hostages to a military airport, and there the Germans launch this disastrous botched operation to rescue the hostages, which basically ends up with everybody being killed. All the hostages are killed, and I think all the hostage takers. And this is the not all the hostage takers.
They get hunted down.
Right. By the Israel has this Operation Wrath of God, as it's called, Mossad. There's a brilliant book about this by a guy called, I think it's called Ronan Bergman, called Rise and Kill First or Rise and Strike First or something, which I reviewed a few years ago. Really riveting read. And of course, Steven Spielberg's film Munich is all about this, about the hunt for the people who planned it and so on. And again, Avery Brundage is there. And he says, you know, the politics and sport can't mix. The games will go on. So in other words, he's perfectly happy to have the games in Hitler's Berlin. And he thinks the games should continue despite the fact that one of the teams has just seen 11 of its members murdered. And you sort of think, well, if he's not going to stop it then or postpone it or do something, would you ever stop it? And I guess his answer would have been no, he never would. So, yeah, go on, Tom.
That taint, Berlin Olympics, Munich, the greed, the Cold War rivalries. I mean, I think it is a kind of permanent shadow over any idea that the Olympics are a festival of...
I completely agree. So when you mentioned in the last podcast, the first one we did on this, on the modern Olympics, about David Goldblatt's book, and I was looking back at David Goldblatt's book, and he wrote an article just before the current Olympics, the Tokyo Olympics, in which he basically argues, he says, you know, that the Olympics should stop. They should be wound up. And he gives a series of facts, actually, which are, you know, we've seen in our recent sort of lifetimes, Los Angeles, Seoul, Barcelona. I mean, Barcelona is probably the one great success story because it really raised Barcelona's reputation massively.
Yeah, the city, because the city is the star of that, right?
Yeah, Catalonia, I think, a big boost to Catalan nationalism.
But also, I mean, it's the one that after the end of the Cold War, so the old Soviet-American rivalry is slightly put to bed.
I think that's right, and I think it's probably the least tainted. So then you have Atlanta 1996. I mean, an awful game. It's a pipe bomb attack, but also it should never have been given to Atlanta. Everybody agrees that. The organisation was poor. It was a complete sellout to kind of Coca-Cola, and you know, it should have been Athens. Should be because it's centenary.
Yeah.
I think the Sydney games are pretty good.
But then Athens is...
I mean,
it's a financial disaster, isn't it?
Just before the financial crisis as well. I mean, you think what happened to Greece just a few years later, that they've blown all this money on the games. It's
kind of lent, and kind of like the IOC are like dealers. They're like the kind of mafia encouraging people to get into gambling debts.
They absolutely
so are. That then they can take over their sports shop or something. I mean that's what it felt like with Athens.
Yeah, agreed. You
know, that Greece got horribly stiffed, basically.
I mean, the Beijing Games were obviously an advert for the Chinese regime, no doubt. No one would sort of dispute that. The London Games...
A magnificent monument to Blairism.
Well, we loved... I mean, everybody in Britain loved the London Games because we did really well, because we made a...
We like the Queen.
Daniel Craig was in it. But it was very expensive, and it left... It didn't increase participation in sport, which everybody claimed it would, and it left London with... I'm not going to say the Olympic Park is a white elephant, but it is a bit of a white elephant. You know, there's...
But good news for West Ham, right?
It's not as much of a white elephant as the Montreal... Yeah, if you're a hammer. Although they hate their new stadium. They can't stand their
Everyone's unhappy.
Yeah. And then what was the last one? Rio. I mean, Rio, terrible story. You know, they didn't... just reading here from David Goldblatt's article, Rio did not build a single community sporting facility on the back of these Olympic Games. And they forced out 60,000 people to move out of their homes to make way for Olympic infrastructure. I mean, that's kind of... I think that's pretty indefensible, actually.
Yeah.
So these... I mean, the stats are extraordinary. Goldblatt says, no modern games, with the exception of Barcelona, has ever raised a host city's rate of economic growth, level of skills and employment, tourist income, or productivity. It's a complete myth that they raise the level of sporting participation in the country. Actually, lots of people watch the Olympics on TV, but they don't then emulate the... I mean, that's the sort of claim that these people... You know, Olympians... I mean, I admire these athletes tremendously who've dedicated their lives to the pursuit of glory and all the rest of it, but... The idea that they inspire others is dubious at best. I mean, they may inspire some.
Kid in the ghetto, dreaming of dressage.
That's always... Well, that's the, yeah. I mean, who didn't grow up in a slum dreaming of synchronized swimming? That's always the claim, isn't it? But I think the truth of it is a lot... has always been much darker. And we shouldn't kid ourselves.
I think it has right from the beginning. Because you think about all the, you know, the human zoos.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. It's kind of monstrous, really.
So this is all very bleak, isn't it? And if it's not bleak enough, I'll tell you this. There's an extraordinary story about a Japanese marathon runner called Kokichi Subayara. I'm sorry if I've pronounced that wrong to Japanese.
Oh, is this the one in Helsinki or Stockholm?
It's at Tokyo, I think it is, 64. Okay. But it might be the one you're thinking of. So he comes third in the marathon. He'd hoped to win. And he ends up walking. You know, he's been going for 26 miles. It's fair enough. He basically stumbles across the line in front of his home crowd, and he's very disappointed. And he says, I have committed an inexcusable blunder in front of the Japanese people. I have to make amends by running and hearing the anthem in our next Olympics. So for the next 3 years, this poor guy trains like a demon to get into the next Olympics, when he can redeem, as he sees it, the shame of having finished third in front of his home crowd. He has a back injury just before the Olympics, so he can't go. So do you know what he does? I mean, you can probably guess. He leaves the notes. He kills himself.
Yeah, okay, so that is a depressor. That is a downer. But there's a slightly more inspiring one, which I get, because I think it would be remiss to dwell just on the dark side.
Okay.
Because clearly kind of incredible inspiration.
Yeah.
People watch it because they find it moving and inspiring.
To be honest, I'm a complete hypocrite, because when we win, when the commentator says,
your columns for the Daily Mail
when the commentator says, oh, this lad from Hunstanton, his family watching back home, I mean, I'm in kind of floods of tears. I'm a pitiful figure.
Okay, so this anecdote I'm about to tell is going to be a terrible anecdote, because I can't really remember it.
Okay.
I was told it years ago by, I think, David Owen, great sports journalist coverage.
Not the Olympics. The SDP? Not the SDP.
No. The sports editor of the FT.
Okay.
And somebody mentioned it also on Twitter a couple of days ago, but it's in one of the Scandinavian Olympics, and I'm guessing it's either Stockholm. I think it's Stockholm. There's a marathon. There's a Japanese runner. he realizes midway through that he's not going to win a medal, and he's so ashamed that he stops the race and he just goes home without telling anyone. So nobody knows where he's gone. So he just vanishes.
Yeah.
And he's gone back to Tokyo. And yeah, and after the war, the Swedes kind of discover that this has happened, and they invite him back to Sweden to complete the course, and he does it. And everyone turns out in Stockholm to cheer him over the finish line.
That's a lovely story.
So that is a good story.
That's a bit like the Derek, you know, the Derek Redmond story. I mean, people who know about athletics will definitely know this story. So there was a very accomplished British runner at the turn beginning of the 1990s called Derek Redmond, but he was plagued by injuries, and he got himself fit, I think, just for Barcelona, and he was in the final, and he had a really, really, really good expectation of a medal, and I'm sure you've seen it, Tom. He goes, but his hamstring goes halfway round, and he slows to a crawl, it's a stagger. And a man runs onto the field.
Yeah.
A sort of older, quite sort of large black man. And the organisers are trying to sort of hold him back. But it turns out this man is his dad. And his dad helps him across the line. And it's this incredibly sort of... Even the Olympic sort of... The official Olympic website makes mention of this. You know, 'cause obviously he comes in behind everybody else. But his dad is determined that his son will finish, and he basically helps him.
So actually, you know, it's very like the story of Ferenike that we talked about in the first of our trilogy, the mother who helps her son,
yeah,
to win the boxing or the wrestling. I can't remember which it is.
And she's not wearing any underwear, and they reckon
she's not wearing any underwear. Yeah. And the penalty is officially that she'd be chucked off a cliff.
Yeah, but that didn't happen to the Redmond family.
The IOC decide that they'll spare her. Well, so, very similar.
That's a nice
moving moment.
That's a very nice moment on which to end. And one last note on which to end, Tom, to return to the patriotic spirit which we began these two podcasts on, the modern Olympics. Do you know there's only one country that has won a gold medal in every single Summer Games? I'll give you one guess, which one.
Is it the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland?
It is.
Well, and before we became the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, of course, we won gold in the only cricket match.
Yeah.
Paris 1900.
And we win the...
So we remain the gold medal winners in cricket. And I think that's a splendid note. Yeah.
We win the Aquatic Olympics every year. So, I mean, they're the real games.
Yeah, yeah. The Cotswold Olympics, really, it's a victory for them.
Yeah, exactly.
So well done, them.
Right.
Thanks very much for listening.
We've got Sparta coming up, haven't we? And lots of stuff about the Berlin Wall and nuclear weapons and tons of interesting stuff. So
see you soon.
See you next time. Bye-bye.